Hello and welcome to another episode of The Last Video Store, the show where I, Alexi Toliopoulos, your friend in film, talk to cool, funny, and interesting people about their favorite films in the style of an old school video store rental combo that includes a personalized staff pick recommendation from me. And on this episode, this is one of my favorite chats I've ever recorded. I recorded this episode during the Melbourne International Film Festival in 2025. I've held on to it for a little while because I love this film that I talk about so much that I wanted more people to be able to see it. But it has yet to be released in outside the festival system in Australia. But I'm here talking to one of my filmmaking heroes of all time, the great Athena Rachel Tsangari, Greek filmmaker. She has made some of my favorite films, including Chevalier, which I talked to her about. I remember seeing that at the Sydney Film Festival, it having a tremendous impact on me, and I get to talk to her about this. But the film that we're talking about is her new release film, Harvest, starring Caleb Landry Jones. I think this is just a magnificent film. Absolutely one of my favorite films of 2025. I think I talked about it in the Best of 2025 episode with Kate Jinx as well.
Yep.
I just adore this film. I'm here with producer Em as well.
Yes.
You haven't had a chance to see this film yet.
No, but I love Caleb Landry Jones. I think he's a fantastic actor. I love everything he's in. And so I would be so keen to see Harvest. You said it was amazing.
He's mesmerizing this film. Like, I think it's to me, it's my favorite performance of his to date.
Yeah.
And I think that this film from Athena is so beautiful, so powerful, and just like one of those films I just adored the experience of being able to see it in the cinema and letting it wash over me. I hope people get to see it in some way soon. I do believe it will get at least some kind of MUBI release here in Australia. But definitely I'm releasing this episode now because I just want people to be able to see it.
Been hyping it for a while as well, teasing it for a little bit.
I just had such a good time talking to Athena. We really hit it off.
Yep.
We spent a lot of time together in Melbourne during the film festival and just had some great Q&As with her. But this episode is one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. Athena was introducing me to people saying I was like her little Australian cousin and stuff. Which just meant a lot to get that, that validation for this show and that I work really hard in doing and work really hard in connecting to people with films and interviewing people with films. For someone who has been a hero of mine for at least 10 years to give me that validation, felt very, very special. Athena also produced Yorgos Lanthimos' films in Greece from Dogtooth, Canada Alps, and Attenberg, great film as well. Truly just can't say anything beautiful stuff about Athena, one of my heroes. So without further ado, we'll get into this chat. I will give a quick little plug to my show VHS, which is at Adelaide Fringe Festival, Melbourne Comedy Festival, and Sydney Comedy Festival. Tickets are moving very fast on all of those. So if you want to come, please do pick up tickets. I'd love to share my love of film with you in the flesh. And if you hang out after the show, I'll give you a freaking recommendation. Have a drink with me, give you a recommendation. Would love to do that. Until then, let us get into our chat with Athena Rachel Tsangari. Truly, I've said like 10 times in this intro, one of my actual heroes. Love this chat. Athena Rachel Tsangari, thank you so much for joining me here in The Last Video Store.
Thank you so much, Alexei, for inviting me.
I'm so happy to have you here. You're a filmmaker I really admire, and you're here in Melbourne for the Melbourne International Film Festival. You're serving on the jury for Bright Horizons. How have the films been? It feels like an amazing lineup this year.
It's incredible. It's actually going to be very difficult for us tomorrow, I think, during the deliberation, because every film is just exceptional.
Do you feel like the future of cinema is strong after having seen all these films?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a strong yes.
I've seen a few of them myself this year, and I particularly loved A Useful Ghost. So it's been so great. I mean, I was trying to see all of them, but so far has been amazing.
I mean, I can't single out
of course
single film, but and especially since it's second and first and second features. Mm. So it's really like the new generation of filmmakers breaking through from all over the world. And it's, you know, to see, because these are kind of like the best, you know, emerging filmmakers from this year.
Yeah, from around the entire festival. World.
So, yeah, it's actually overwhelming.
Yeah.
And yeah, very optimistic in terms of lots of films actually shot on film. So I'm happy to see that young filmmakers are going back to celluloid.
Yeah, it's very enticing to see that there's so many people that are embracing like that filmic look, because you can tell a difference, especially when you're seeing it projected. Mm-hmm. It makes such a difference, it adds such a richness to it. I'm sure it's something we'll talk about a lot in our conversation here. But one thing I really want to kick off our chat with was one of the greatest cinema going experiences of my life was at a film festival seeing your film Chevalier. And I saw it with a friend of mine who's not Greek. And it was one of the great pleasures of my life to see Sakis Rovas, one of the greatest, biggest Greek pop sensations ever, appear in this film. An amazing performance from him. And for me to turn to my friend and go, you have no idea how crazy it is that this man is in this movie. It would be like if Usher appeared in the film. Can you tell me about everything about casting him and working with him? Because I thought that was just such a surprise.
Yes. I mean, it was, I have to say, the only actor I thought of casting for this part immediately. And in fact, with my casting director, Anna Nicolaou, it was, I think, the beginning of the summer. And he was, you know, for your audience who probably doesn't know who Sakis is, because I assume it's not just
not
Greeks.
Just Greeks. They're my favorites of the audience, but there's others.
Yeah, but I mean, he's gigantic, right? Like he's probably one of the most important men in the contemporary history of Greece.
Yeah.
You know, it's like not just you know, a great artist, a very gifted performer, but also you know, he's a philanthropist. Mm. He's, you know, he's a great human being. And usually I kind of like mixing different types of performers. Mm. And I say performers because he's an actor, but he's basically like a genius performer.
Yeah.
With every part of his intellect, his body, his voice, everything. Yeah. Since he was a very young boy. So for some reason, I don't know, you know, and while Efthymis and I were writing the script, I had him in mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a independent film. It's not, you know, I was not going to make like a pop film.
Mm.
So we just called up his agent and asked him if he could come, you know, meet me and my casting agent, who is also my assistant director. And at that point, he was performing actually at the ancient theater of Epidaurus.
Mm. Yeah.
So he was doing, I think it was Aristophanes, although don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that he was actually doing, you know, Greek.
Yeah.
Ancient Greek. I think it was, I don't remember.
Yeah.
And also, for your audience to know that I'm deeply jet lagged. And after a very, very long tour in Europe with Harvest, I came 2.5 years, not years, days. It feels like years, but it's actually 2.5 days in Melbourne.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my memory is not.
That's okay.
So he came, you know, so he drove actually from Epidaurus because he was performing every night.
Yeah.
So he left in the morning. He drove to Athens. We were going to meet for an hour. We met for like 3.
Mm.
And I don't audition with scenes. Ever, you know, I just discuss the film. And he hadn't really, I mean, he hadn't read the script. He just knew that I was getting ready to make a new film, which was going to be with a full male cast.
Yeah.
And it was, I just knew, you know, just receiving kind of like the vibe that he had.
Mm.
and the enthusiasm that he had about, you know, working together. So I cast him, and I rehearsed for a long time before I started shooting.
Yeah.
So our executive producer, Christos Kostandakopoulos, he, you know, he offered us the location, which was a very small yacht, which was in Faliro, outside of Athens. So basically about half hour away from downtown Athens. So all of my actors, who are quite big actors in Greece, and they were working either in television or in theater, they would just drive or jump on the motorcycles every morning. They would come to rehearse and then leave at night to go to their...
their day jobs, yeah.
Their night jobs, yeah. And, you know, Sakis would go and sing in that. Yeah. So, and, you know, there was a bit of Chevalier going there in rehearsals because they were all, like, the best actors of their generations and from very different backgrounds. So I think there was, in the beginning, a bit of checking each other out.
A bit of male dominations going on.
Yeah, and then in the end, and I remember the day, and of course, Sakis, right, being like this mega
star.
But at the same time, I have to say, the most humble of all of them. You know, I remember him arriving one day with like huge fish that he had caught over the weekend, because he's also an incredible...
My God, the guy can do it all.
Yeah. So not only that, he arrives with this huge, gigantic... I don't remember what it was, what fish, but it was gigantic, and he had caught it himself. And he goes into the little kitchen of the yacht, and he makes sashimi. You know, he just basically does it.
My gosh.
You know, he had brought his super duper Japanese knife, and then he served it to the rest of the cast, and that was it. I think they all fell in love with him.
Wow, that's so amazing to hear.
Yeah.
Before we start talking about some of the movies you want to talk about today, I want to ask you as well, what were the video stores you had like growing up, or what were the video stores where you discovered your films like?
There was a video store that was called Blue.
Blue.
Yeah. Video Blue. And it had a few, you know, the best one was, I think it's still there in Exarchia, which is, you know, this really vital, like, artist area. Have you been in Athens?
I've not been for a very long time.
Okay. So, so this was, and, you know, there's, you know, Greek is a huge cinephile country, and we all grow up watching films from very young. Also because, you know, on our public television channels, the film programmers are completely obsessed with cinema.
Yeah.
You know, so usually after 11 o'clock at night and until 6 in the morning, they play masterpieces.
Wow.
So because once, you know, once the Greek television, and we're talking about three different public channels, they acquire the rights to show them, then they can show them forever.
Yeah.
I assume. So, so yeah, it was, you know, I mean, I remember watching even The Dwarfs Started Small by Herzog.
By Herzog.
So I remember watching it when I was like 13.
On TV.
On TV.
Wow.
And then there is another amazing channel that's the, it's called Vouli. It's the Parliament channel.
Yeah.
That's, you know, during the day, it shows sessions of the parliament.
Yeah.
Which was actually kind of like the inspiration for Chevalier.
Yeah.
In a roundabout way, all this man.
Yeah, arguing.
Arguing, you know, when the crisis descended about Greece, and arguing without any solution or any course of logic or responsibility or reliability or anything like that. So anyway, so this is during the day, which is like the best performance, you know, live performance piece you could watch. And then after 11, again, they play actually the best art house movies.
Wow.
So I grew up basically staying up until 5 in the morning.
Receiving your film education.
Receiving my film education, yeah. And then falling asleep on the sofa and then being waking up, going to school, and then going back to... So it was, in a way, that was, you know, at least in the 80s, that was my own video store. And then Video Blue, you know, I'm not sure, because there were some incredible films that I could not even imagine that any Greek distributor would buy. So I assume there were some other ways of getting those really precious VHS tapes of, you know, like, I don't know, experimental American film, you know, like Stan Brakhage, for example.
Yeah.
You know, to first see when I was like, whatever, 12, 13, together with, you know, some of my mom's tapes, Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah.
Also Stan Brakhage. You know, and just see abstract cinema.
Yeah.
You know, a revelation. Pasolini. Mm. You know, all of Pasolini.
New release.
Well, that's so beautiful. To have such a... that's who we want to have on this show. People with like a deep love of film. So I really want to talk to you about your new release film, which I just saw the other day, and it astounded me. Your new film, Harvest.
Art House.
I absolutely adored this film. You said something about it and about your work that I found just so fascinating that I would love to start our conversation with there. You said that you start from genre and then you destroy it. Can you talk about your sense of genre when it came to this movie, Harvest?
Yes, it's, you know, it's a period film based on a novel by Jim Crace. In the end of the Middle Ages in England, the destruction of a community in the space of a week, an agrarian community, basically humans being replaced by sheep, and sheep basically signifying the beginning of capitalism, industrial revolution. Mm. Yeah, and in order to kind of like always enter the visual language, especially since there was an adaptation that was a bitch to do. So this one I saw as a Western in terms of the archetypical setup of, you know, a small community that lives quite peacefully. Then there is this, you know, there's usually like a hero, a very moral man. It's always a man. sometimes a woman, like, you know, Johnny Guitar or The Furies by Anthony Mann, one of my favorite films of all times. Johnny Guitar also.
Yeah.
So there's usually this moral man, and then the villain comes with some kind of, you know, theft or destruction scheme. And then that hero basically defends the community, and there is a big showdown in the end, and Bob's your uncle. So I just thought it was interesting to keep this structure, but instead of a hero, it's the total anti-hero of someone who's actually quite paralyzed.
Yeah.
And inactive. You know, he wants to act, but he just can't.
He doesn't have it within him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk about the characters in this and character and performance, because that performance that we're talking about is Walter, played by Caleb Landry Jones. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this beautiful dichotomy between him and Quill, who's like a cartographer, I guess, mapping out this location, played by Rinzi Keen. And I think these two performances, these two characters are so... There's something so wonderful about them. Can you talk about the way that you see those characters?
That was the other genre that I love, which is the buddy movie.
Yeah.
You know, so it's sort of like a little buddy movie in the middle of this anti-Western. Yeah, I was very moved actually by the relationship in the novel, because it is this, they're both outsiders. Mm. Walter Thirsk, played by Caleb, is an outsider himself because he grew up with his master, who was also sort of like his childhood friend, the son of the nanny of his master. He doesn't really belong in the village. He's not really an agrarian man. Mm. He's not really a farmer. But he has found his calling in this connection that he has with the land in a way that no one else does. Mm. It's almost like he has this secret, holy connection with it. But it's obvious that he aspires to more. If he had been educated, he would have been an artist himself.
Yeah.
So he sees a projection of himself to the cartographer, who basically comes to destroy the community as the tool of power. Yeah. So it's, you know, those two outsiders.
Both being used by capitalism.
Both being tools of capitalism and ultimately crushed. So you see them, though, in this state of grace.
Yeah.
Which it was beautiful also because of the friendship that was developed between Arinze and Caleb. Arinze, you know, being one of the most brilliant performers and writers of his generation in England. He's a playwright and a choreographer and a director and martial artist and like everything.
Yeah, a regular Sakis Rovas, he can do everything.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I guess it's also nice because it's great for me to be working with I mean, I love having other directors on set, for example. You know, Sean Price-Williams, the cinematographer.
He directed The Sweet East a couple of years ago.
You know, he's a director himself.
Yeah.
Sweet East was his second feature, actually. So, Alena Lokina.
Yeah.
You know, from Melbourne.
Great Australian filmmaker.
Great Australian filmmaker. I met her as my fellow at this screenwriting and directing lab that I used to run in Greece, and she was a brilliant fellow for her film Petrol.
Yeah.
So we spent the pandemic basically for a year on Zooms discussing her script as she kept working on subsequent drafts. So I was her mentor, I guess.
Yeah.
And then when I was getting ready to make the film, I don't know how she found out. So she emailed me and she said, you know, would I be able to come as your shadow director?
Yeah, your attachment, yeah.
Which is, you know, I mean, I wish I had this opportunity when I was starting out, you know, this thing to be a shadow director. Basically, she was, I can't even sum up how much she did for me.
Yeah.
For everyone, with everyone, the research that she did on all the music, you know, it's a world. And we had very little time to build this world.
Yeah. You do it so beautifully, especially like the contribution of Sean Price-Williams, cinematographer. You worked with him on Trigonometry, the TV series.
Mm-hmm.
The quality that he brings to this film is so beautiful, so painterly, to capture nature in such a beautiful way. And the way it kind of twists and turns throughout the film as well comes through in the actual cinematic language of it. Can you talk about, I guess, finding the look of this film? It feels so beautiful. It feels so natural and wonderful.
Yeah, because it was a very natural collaboration. So we just all completely surrendered ourselves to this abundant gift of nature. You know, the film is about that.
Yeah.
It's an ode and a lament to nature as it's being destroyed, reappropriated. And once you're in that landscape, that, you know, Rebecca O'Brien, my great producer on the ground, she's Scottish herself. She took me there. We drove up and down the coast in Argyllshire, Western Scotland. And once we found this place, we just knew. You know, it was 360 degrees because I shoot 360.
Yeah.
And I never stop once I start. I just, and Sean is very much this way.
Yeah,
there was a sensory immersion in the process of making the film. And we were a great gang of outsiders, a band of outsiders, there for 4 months. And once you have, once you build this community, and once there is this, you know, sense of fun, because that's important to have fun.
Yeah.
Because cinema has become really industrialized. And like in Chevalier, for example, you know, we all lived and worked together. You know, it was a 90% female crew.
Yeah.
And a 100% male cast. And we were all on this very small boat, you know, for 3 months, including rehearsals. And you just become a family, and it's so important to have communal meals and, you know, to do whatever, yoga together or to dance every Friday night.
Yeah.
And play each other music, you know, so sort of like, it's almost like camp, summer camp.
Yeah.
So this kind of sense that that was during the shoot, our hope was that it was going to permeate.
Yeah, imbue itself into the film. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really evident. And I think it's that connection to land and environment that serves this film so wonderfully and why it just translates right off the screen. And the film has...
And also we didn't go against anything.
You allowed it? How do you,
I mean,
do you
it
mean
was raining
that?
All the time and there was mud up to our, you know, belly buttons. And that was also beautiful that, you know, with Sean or with the other huge hero on the set, which was David, our sound recordist. Mm. You know, he was actually building a symphony out of everyone's voices because he had, at a given moment, he would have like sometimes 30, 35 mics going.
Wow.
You know, lavs and then three booms going at the same time to allow me what I had asked him, which is there's going to be overlapping dialogue and you're never going to know who is going to be speaking and when. So no one really talks about the sound, you know, the magic, the miracle of basically live sound.
Yeah.
It's really like he was recording a concert.
That's so beautifully put, because I think this is a great example of storytelling by soundscape, this film. Like, you can hear so much of the nature. You can hear the sounds of, like, insects, the sounds of birds. And like you said, it's a symphony that comes together.
That's also Nicola Becker, our sound designer.
Yeah.
Who had actually gotten an Oscar for his sound design for Sounds of Metal.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was... What can I say? You know, I had an incredible team, and I don't think you can make a film unless there is an incredible team. And most of the work was in the 3 years that I was preparing the film. Mm. And once, you know, I cast as much my crew, I spent as much casting my crew as the cast. So it took about a year to find everyone, because I also want to make sure that all the energies work together, especially when we all live in the same quarters. And because of the way I work, which is once I start, I don't stop.
Yeah.
And I shoot the entire scene over and over. And everyone needs to be like really prepared and really there. Yeah.
The only other thing I want to ask you before we move on to some of the movies that inspired you and influenced you, was the film has a dedication to your grandparents and their farmland at the end. Mm-hmm. And it feels like a beautiful encapsulation of like this artistic message from you about connection to land. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, my paternal grandparents were farmers, you know, in a long lineage of farmers in Thessaly, right outside Karditsa. I don't know if you've been there, but, yeah, you know, sort of like the breadbasket of, yeah, Greece, growing cotton, wheat, corn, and the best watermelons I've ever, yeah, had, carpuzzi.
Yeah.
So our parents would park myself and my sister there once the school was done. And, you know, that was they knew what they were doing, right? Because it was a great education on how to be humble and how to work hard, because we're actually really working the fields.
Yeah.
And how to listen to the land and how to respect her. And how to, you know, feed cows and all of the, you know, harness of chickens and how to build a fire and how to cook and all of that. So, it just so happened that the, you know, the biggest new highway in Greece that connects central Athens with basically central Greece and northern western Epiros. Mm. So that happened to go through our land, and you know, when that happens, when the state decides, yeah, there's nothing you can do. And unfortunately, that was through most of our land. So when that happened, which was devastating, also for all of my cousins, and I just knew that I wanted to do something. And I'm not good about making autobiographical stuff. I always try to have some distance. So when when the novel was sent to me, I just said, okay, this is what I have to do. Yeah. And it doesn't matter whether it was in England or in Greece or in Kenya or in Texas or here in Victoria, you know, it is the same story that keeps, yeah, happening over and over again.
Yeah. Well, that's so beautifully put. I love this film. I can't wait for more people to see it so I can talk to more people about it. But I think it's just absolutely an astounding work of art in every sense of the word.
Weekly.
Let's talk about some of the other movies that inspired this in some way. I feel like this leads really nicely into a talk about another film that I think took the Western genre and then destroyed it. And using a lot of the same techniques that we've been talking about today, we're talking about McCabe and Mrs. Miller from Robert Altman.
Western.
Why did you pick this movie up today?
Because it's one of my favorite films of all times. And why is that? That's always tough to describe, right? Because, yeah, it's also like a very
personal connection.
It's a very personal, you know, you never know why you connect it with a film and not with with another. Mm. Altman in general is one of my top heroes. I worship him. I love the way he welcomes and works with chaos. Mm. He's not afraid of that.
Mm.
You know, the film company that the production company that we created 18 years ago, through which we made some of our, you know, Greek new wave or whatever weird wave unfortunate name, but anyway, you know, it's called House Film, which is HAOS. So it's a composite word between chaos and house.
Mm.
You know, so it's this beautiful equilibrium, you know, between order and disorder. And I love inviting chaos into my life in general. And sort of like figuring out how to turn entropy around. So My Cabin and Miss Miller, it is a Western, definitely. But again, it's really such a sorrowful film, you know, about a dreamer who gets destroyed by capital, and about another dreamer, Mrs. Miller, who is also crushed again by capital. So in such a beautiful, you know, you can hardly understand what they say, you know, it's all mumbling.
Yeah.
But isn't this how we are normally? You know, it's almost like you're plopped in somewhere where something is happening instead of standing outside it and describing it. So for my next film, if I make another, it's sort of like where I'm going towards less description and more immersion.
More immersion. I mean, I think this is one
of those... He was also like such a renegade. And, you know, he invented like this whole live, multiple
track recording.
Track recording and overlapping and...
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
It's almost with this film, it's not exactly what they're saying. It's about the attitude or what you hear from what they're saying. It makes you pay attention, I think, more in a really active way. And also what hovers over the rest of the film's soundtrack is those Leonard Cohen songs. They feel so like mournful poetry or something to it all. That just, I don't know, it's one of those things that always draws me in with this movie.
Yeah, and also... they were not written for the movie.
Yeah.
It just happened that this record was out while they were editing, and I think his editor just started playing them, and Altman, of course, was like, hey, that's great, because I cannot imagine this movie without Leonard Cohen. Because it is mourning the end of an era.
Mm. And it's that beautiful cinematography from Vilmos Zsigmond, which he treated the film with light so it would like capture the images in a different way. There's like not a film that looks like this, really.
No, but also, but of course it looks incredible, but at the same time, it is also the decision by a director who said, we're all going to shoot in 20 feet of falling snow, you know, and we're not going to stop, you know. Yeah. And then you have like one of the best endings in the history of cinema while, you know, you have everyone chasing each other in this incredible snowstorm.
Yeah.
And they really actually, you know, it's not an effect. They didn't do it in a studio. They were embedded in this quite hostile landscape for months and months, while at the same time they were building the town, you know. So in a way, I think the best films, like Apocalypse Now is another one of my all-time favorites. It's a documentary of the making of this film as much as the story.
Yeah.
You know, of the film.
The film is a document of itself.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's so beautifully put. I mean, and I think McCabe and Mrs. Miller is such a great example of that. The other film that you've brought as well is another film that I would put in that same category. And this is a film, I think that there's this running theme of like what we've been looking at, which is, I guess, capital and colonialization taking over land and the destruction of like native land. And when I think of that, there's probably very few movies I would put as high as this film. This is Zama from Lucretia Martel.
Mm-hmm.
Drama.
From 2017, it's set in a remote South American colony in the late 18th century, and Officer Zama of the Spanish Crown waits in vain for a transfer to a more prestigious location. He suffers small humiliations and petty politicking as he increasingly succumbs to lust and paranoia, is how this film is described. This is a film that is so handsome, beautifully photographed, but it's that examination of that colonizer mentality that I think really works for this film, and doing so through the language of film I think is just beautiful. Can you talk to me about, I guess, where to start? The framing of this film I think is what really works, like those framings that feel like paintings rather than point of view perspectives capture like this great colonizer eye on the land.
Yeah, I mean, I would choose any of Lucrezia's films for any for any cinema discussion in the 21st century, because I think she's a master.
Mm.
And I don't know, there is not really a female, is there a female word for that? You know, because it's like masters, right? They're always men.
Yeah.
So
Martels, they should be now.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a Martel. She's a genius. And and she also has taught me a lot, you know, by looking at her mise-en-scène.
Mm.
I don't call it framing.
Mm.
And I don't call it cinematography either. And I think that's a common kind of misconception when something kind of looks good,
yeah,
or it has interesting frames, yeah, that it's always a cinematographer,
yeah,
because that's a really huge part of the director.
Yeah,
not every director is interested in mise-en-scène.
Yeah,
you know, there's directors who love directing actors and directors who are mostly screenwriters who want to be in control of their scripts. Mm. But there are a few of us who actually really love blocking and mise-en-scène. And she's, you know, she's, as I said, she's a master, and she's someone who taught me a lot.
Yeah.
Just by looking, you know, when she did, for example, La Mujer Sin Cabeza, The Headless Woman, you know, it was a film where literally half of the frames, you know, were headless bodies. You know, she would never reframe.
Mm.
So that meant something, you know. So once you start entering this sort of logic, which is actually there to represent, as you said, colonialism, which is a huge part of her cinema as an Argentinian filmmaker from the north. Then you start realizing, okay, you know, there is a thought process that goes in terms of how she, you know, it's a frame, right? But it's you have so much control as to how you're going to tell the story in terms of sound also. You know, she's a huge sound weaver. She spends months and months with her mixer. She always works with the same mixer in a studio in Paris. Zama, as a film about colonialism, and again with a total anti-hero, you know, someone who's basic, like, he doesn't really have a moral spine.
Mm-hmm.
He's a coward. He's trying to negotiate the system really unsuccessfully. You know, and it, I also find it like a very funny film.
Yeah.
You know, like dark humor.
He's constantly humiliated, you
exactly
know?
Which is not something that you see. Also an adaptation, you know, by quite momentous novel that she had to
harness and
to
try.
Harness, yeah. Exactly. Yes. So I think it's one of the best films of this century. And I have to say something, though, that I like remembering films. Mm. So, you know, I think I send you like the whole list of the films that were references.
Yeah.
That very specifically, I didn't rewatch any of them.
Just to keep it how it was in your brain.
Also because, you know, for me, it's not ever direct reference.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like this accumulation of, it's almost movies that I've seen as dreams.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very bad with plots.
Yeah.
So I'm actually quite proud that I had so much to say about his character.
Yeah.
At Zama, for example.
Yeah.
Or McCabe and Miss Miller, because actually McCabe, I watched again because recently, but only after like 10 years or so. I mean, I've seen it maybe 5 or 6 times in my life. I saw that at the Midnight Sun Film Festival. Talking about the film festival, I was there before Melbourne in Lapland, the north of Finland, and it's the film festival that the Kaurismäki brothers are putting on, and it was the 40th anniversary, and the team of the programmer there, the festival director, actually, he wanted me to present McCabe and Miss Miller on film because the Finnish Cinematheque had a print.
Beautiful.
So I actually watched it, and it was literally a print from the 70s.
Wow.
You know, so it was like very red and sometimes very purple, and it had Finnish subtitles and this incredible crackling sound. Oh, it was just amazing. So I saw it recently in Lapland, and it's as if, in a way, someone had recorded my dream.
Wow.
You know, so it's because I was remembering all of these things, and then I kept talking to Sean, for example, without having seen it recently. And it was really like narrating a fragments of memories of a dream. And then suddenly I see that dream again reconstituted. And it was actually much better than I remembered it even.
Wow. That's so beautiful. What I'm feeling emotional hearing that.
Oh.
That's so beautiful, Athena.
Staff pick.
Wow. Well, I think that puts the pressure on me to try and give you a good staff pick recommendation of something good. And whenever
we've got people
from overseas, I try to recommend something Australian to try and share Australian cinema with the world. And we do also have a great history of Westerns and deconstructions of Westerns in Australia that deal with that idea of colonization. So it's something that's very vibrant here, and there's a lot of films to choose from. There were two that came to mind, so I might even recommend you two movies if you like.
All right.
But you might have seen them, I'm not
sure.
Bring
them on.
The first one that I was thinking of that came to mind straight away, which I think is one of the great films in the last few years from Australia, directed by Warwick Thornton, who I think is one of our master filmmakers as well.
Yes.
It's called Sweet Country.
Western.
Have you seen Sweet Country?
I have seen Sweet Country.
I thought you might have seen Sweet Country, but I think that's one that has such a beautiful connection to land as well, where you see these Australian landscapes, even ones that I'd never seen before.
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous. These like salt.
And I'm also such a huge admirer of his cinema.
Yeah.
And everything he stands for.
Yeah, I think so.
And also he has this kind of also, if I may say, punk energy.
Absolutely.
That I really admire in my contemporaries.
Yeah.
You know, very political. And at the same time, yes, he's a mise-en-scène director.
Absolutely, right.
So I saw it, yeah. I love Westerns.
Yeah.
So I'm really trying to watch. Yeah. I mean, having seen my list.
Yeah.
And especially when they're kind of like a little bit off kilter.
A bit off kilter. Yeah. The other one I've got is probably even more off kilter.
Okay.
And hopefully, I mean, if you've seen it as well, I've not done my job very well here today. But at least I know you like the movies. The other one is a little bit earlier, from the early 2000s, by Australian filmmaker who I think is one of the great experimenters in Australian film, mm-hmm. who experiments with form in many different ways. But it's a movie called The Tracker by Rolf de Heer. Have you seen this one?
I haven't seen.
Oh, thank gosh. I've done it. Okay. A sense of relief is washing over me. I think you will really, really appreciate this film, especially its approach. And if you compare it to
McCabe and Mrs. It's called The Tracker?
The Tracker. Yeah. It stars David Gulpilil, who is one of our great Australian actors, Indigenous actors, and artists in every kind of form, like great artists. There's a film playing at the festival.
How do you spell his name?
My gosh, how do you spell it? G-U-L-P-I-L-I-L. David Gulpilil. So he's a dancer.
I don't know him.
He's one of his earliest films. He was in Walkabout, the Nicholas Roeg film, as a young man.
Really?
But he's one of the most significant artists in Australian history. And this is a film.
Walk About, another one of my favorite films of all time. Yeah.
So it stars him as the tracker, and the tracker is set somewhere in the early 20th century Australian outback. There is an Aboriginal man who's accused of murdering a white woman, and three men on a mission to capture him with the help of an experienced Indigenous man, which is the tracker. And it was a real thing where they would have these Indigenous men back in the day who would be, they would be their job to help track through the outback and like find their ways around and are working
to
as
colonize their land.
Yeah, to colonize land. Right. So it's it's an evocative film in every way. But what it is about, it starts this great artistic collaboration between David Gulpilil and Rolf de Heer, who made two other films together, and including Ten Canoes, which is a beautiful, beautiful film.
Oh, I've seen Ten Canoes.
And
okay, so that's the director.
That's the director, yeah.
I see.
They've made a few movies together, and he's
Australian.
He's Australian. I think he's Dutch originally, but came to Australia and has made his films in Australia. Many really experimental films, including Bad Boy Bubby, which is another.
I haven't seen that. I've seen Ten Canoes.
Yeah, so I think he really experiments the form in a wonderful way. And what I would compare this to with McCabe and Mrs. Miller, it has an overlaid soundtrack of Archie Roach, who's another great Indigenous artist.
Yeah.
With his music that kind of narrates the story of the film itself.
Extremely known all over the world.
Yeah. And it's all his music, the same way that is Leonard Cohen's voice provides a narration for the film. And there's something about that, it is, I'd say it's in the same way kind of mournful and sorrowful,
mm-hmm.
that is really powerful. And it feels completely experimental.
Where was it shot?
I actually don't know where it was shot. It's been a little while since I've seen it. I think so, yeah. It's shot all out in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the most powerful images in it are when there are things that are too painful to show. The way it shows them is through painting. And there's something about that that I find not really seen anywhere else.
Like historical painting?
Yeah.
Existing paintings?
I can't remember if they're existing or if they're made for it. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's been a while since I've seen this movie, but when I started thinking about films for you, it was one that came to mind very quickly.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I think hopefully you find it somewhere.
I will find it.
Yeah. But it's a really, really beautiful film. The Tracker.
When was it made?
2002.
Okay. So that's...
And its premiere was screened, I think, Adelaide Film Festival with the live music accompaniment from Archie Roach.
Wow.
And so it's been screened like that a few times, but it's a very special way to see that film. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I really, really appreciate it. It's a gift.
Thank you. My gosh. Thank God I gave you a gift of some kind. But Athena, thank you so much for coming on the show. My pleasure to have you here. You're picking up some beautiful movies from the video. So we've got Harvest, your new film, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Zama, and then my recommendation to you, Sweet Country, and of course, The Tracker, which I'm so glad you have yet to see.
What a great, collection.
I think so.
Right?
Yeah.
That would be a great... what is it?
A little box set.
A little box set.
Yeah.
We for the video store.
Them. Yeah, we'll start selling them because of you.
I think that it's important to do these special box sets because it's like the dialectic, you know, between all of these films together.
From all over the world.
From all over the world, yeah.
Well, hopefully people put them all together as well and start watching them as a group of five movies.
Great.
But thank you so much, Athena. It's been my pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Alexei.
The last video store.
So that was my chat with Athena Rotsotsangari. The film is Harvest. I do hope you get to see it. I adore this film. My thanks to her and our friends at Melbourne International Film Festival for putting this episode together. It's been a long time coming. Like this has been in the bank for a while and I didn't want to hold it anymore. I just wanted to get it out into the world because I adored this episode. Truly one of my favorite things I've ever recorded was this chat with Athena. So I hope you enjoyed it too. Hopefully you get to see her film Harvest. But if you can't, see Attenberg, her early work, a beautiful film, Chevalier, also a magnificent film, one of my very favorite films in the last couple of decades, really. So go check those out. In the meantime, come see my show VHS at the comedy festivals. Links are in the show notes. Until then, we'll see you at the movies, baby.